6. The Thunder. 2147, July 20th, 2034. GMT plus 8. Beijing. Lin Bao was alone when the first images came in. He'd arrived at the Defense Ministry 3 hours before the strike, sequestering himself in the conference room, and he waited. The Zhenghe had dispatched long-dwell drones, whose radar and infrared profiles were the size of gnats, over San Diego and Galveston. The static-filled live feed projected ghostly gray onto a screen at the far end of the room. While Lin Bao sat in his armchair at the head of the table, he listened to the drone operator's disembodied voice as it described what it saw. The blast circumference of the crater, the black rain of several pyrocumulus clouds, the otherworldly annihilation of two cities, which appeared as though a wrathful deity had inhaled them up from the earth. The voice was giving words to this single greatest act of human destruction. The more it spoke, the more it took on larger proportions, so that to Lin Bao it soon sounded less and less like the voice of a man, and more as though it were the voice of God himself. If Lin Bao possessed any reservations about his decision to leave the Navy and government service, watching the fallout over San Diego and Galveston gave him complete conviction that his time as a military officer was through. The only question was how to extract himself safely. Not a small task, he realized. After their meeting in Mission Hills, Zhao Luji had by default made himself Lin Bao's direct superior. Even though no table of organization existed that showed Lin Bao and Zhao Luji in the same chain of command, no official would accept Lin Bao's resignation without Zhao Luji's explicit approval. And so Lin Bao could submit his resignation to one person alone, Zhao Luji. However, since leaving Mission Hills, he and Lin Bao had had no direct communication. Not a telephone call, not a meeting, not an email. Zhao Luji had become a ghost, as distant and disembodied as the drones circling the destroyed American cities. Although Lin Bao had heard nothing from Zhao Luji, he did nothing without the old man's tacit approval. That formal approval would, of course, never arrive with Zhao Luji's name on it, or anyone else's name on it, for that matter. The Politburo Standing Committee expressed itself in the language of bureaucratic obfuscation. Direct intent from an individual, or a collection of individuals, was laundered through existing offices, and not infrequently, through non-existent ones. The routing on any memo, the from, often took up the entire first page. Names hardly ever appeared, only those obscure office titles. If a decision from the Politburo Standing Committee went awry, one of these intermediary offices could take any or all of the blame. As Lin Bao watched the live feed from the Zhenghe, one of these bureaucratic messages sat on the desk in front of him. Like the strike's launch order, it had arrived in a sealed envelope. It, too, had an extensive administrative routing directive on its first page. Lin Bao wondered what would happen if he composed his letter of resignation with a reverse of this routing. Like a trail of breadcrumbs, would it lead back to Zhao Leji and the Politburo Standing Committee? He doubted it. He knew, instinctually, that a matter as sensitive as the resignation of a senior admiral couldn't be handled through such channels. If only his departure was as simple as properly formatting a memo. His thoughts inexplicably turned to the one-way radios on the Soviet tanks during the Second World War, that cautionary case study at the U.S. Naval War College about overly centralized command structures. His wife and daughter had loved Newport. The winter snowstorms spent huddled by the fireplace, and that single glorious summer when on weekends they would rent a dinghy from Goat Island and then let out full sail, passing beneath the Claiborne Pell suspension bridge as they headed toward the hulking gray facade of the historic Naval War College, where they'd beach their dinghy and spread a picnic on a blanket in the sand. With his shoes off, reclining alongside his family, Lin Bao had talked about his retirement back then, too. His idea? To teach at the War College. He smiled self-consciously, even thinking of it. How preposterous it seemed now. The disembodied voice interrupted. 22 minutes on station time remaining, standing by for additional taskings. The Combat Information Center on the Zhenghe responded, sending the unmanned flight out into the spectral blastscape to further confirm what was obvious at a glance, the destruction of everything. I would have taught history, thought Lin Bao, his mind wandering as he considered the live feed. His dream to teach was one that he didn't speak of to anyone, not even his wife. Had he acted on it those years ago, he never would have made admiral. He would have retired from the Navy as a commander, a respectable rank. His dual U.S. citizenship and his doctorate would have been enough to land him a job. As a former Chinese naval officer, he would have brought a unique perspective to the faculty. He had never quite relinquished the dream. Over the years, he had composed a curriculum for a few classes in his mind. He never dared write them down. That would have made the dream too real, and deferring it too painful. He imagined himself at the lectern, discussing the ancient Greeks to his American students. The first Persian war, in which Miltiades defeats Darius at Marathon in 490 BC, leads to the second Persian war, in which the Athenian navy, commanded by Themistocles, destroys the Persian navy under Xerxes at Salamis in 480 BC. 10 years of war gives the Greeks 50 years of peace, a golden age. The Athenians secure peace on the Hellespont through the Delian League, a mutual security pact in which the other Greek city-states pay Athens a tribute to protect them against future Persian aggression. Sound familiar? Lin Bao would then imagine himself looking out at his class, at their blank expressions, in which the past held no relevance, in which there was only the future, and that future would always be American. Then, in his imagined class, Lin Bao would tell his students of their past, but also of their future. He would explain how America's golden age was born out of the First and Second World Wars, just as Greece had found its greatest era of prosperity in the aftermath of the two Persian Wars. Like the Athenians with the Delian League, Lin Bao would explain how the Americans consolidated power with mutual security pacts, such as NATO, in which they would make the largest contributions in exchange for military primacy over the Western world, much as the Athenians had gained military primacy of the then-known world through the Delian League. Lin Bao would always wait for the question he knew was coming, in which one of his students would ask why it all ended. What external threat overwhelmed the Delian League? What invader accomplished what the Persian fleet could not at Salamis? And Lin Bao would tell his students that no invader had come. No foreign horde had sabotaged the golden age forged by Miltiades, Themistocles, and Greece's other forefathers. Then how? They would ask. If the Persians couldn't do it, who did? And so, he would say, the end came, as it always does, from within. He would explain this patiently, like a father telling a beloved child that the Easter Bunny or another cherished fairy tale didn't exist. And while his students' puzzled expressions fixed on him, he would tell them about the jealousy of the Spartans, the fear they felt for the broadening powers of the Delian League. He would also tell them about Athens, drunk on its own greatness, blinded by narcissism and decadence. Look over the ages, he would assert, from Britain to Rome. To Greece, the empire always rots from within. Most of his students, he knew, would underwhelm him. They would stare back in disbelief or even hostility. Their assumption would always be that the time in which they lived could never be usurped. It was singular, as they believed themselves to be singular. Endemic dysfunction in America's political life hardly mattered because America's position in the world was inviolate. But a few of his students, their faces clear in his imagination, would return his stare as if his understanding had become their own. What Lin Bao wondered now, as he watched the last of the live feed, the skeletal remains of buildings, the rush hour commute left incinerated on the highway, was what rank those few American students would hold today. Some would likely be admirals, like himself. What if he had retired early? What if he had taught and reached a few of them? Would there have been a Zhengjiang, a San Diego, a Galveston? Probably so. But he allowed himself to conjure an alternative history, one in which the miscalculations of the past 4 months had not occurred, one in which incidents like the Wenwei and battles like Mischief Reef and Taiwan had never happened. Perhaps a single dissenting voice, properly applied, had prevented this collective madness. The historian in him couldn't resist placing these events into a causative order in which each became a link in an otherwise interruptible chain, one that had bound them to this moment. Where Lin Bao, seated at the conference table, staring at the live feed, was witnessing the single greatest act of destruction in the history of mankind. But there was nothing he could do about any of this. The task before him was simple: to observe the last of the live feed and to pass along to the Zhenghe the order that sat in front of him on the table. It tasked the carrier and its escorts to return from the Pacific to the South China Sea at best speed to defend against the American threat in our waters. Another 15 minutes had passed. The drone operator continued to survey the blastscape. Then, with fuel running low, he announced that he'd be checking off station in 7 minutes. With his hollow, disembodied voice, the drone operator radioed to the Zhenghe, asking whether they had any further taskings. The Zhenghe had none. Next, the drone operator called to the Defense Ministry and asked if they had any further taskings. Lin Bao picked up the handset on the satellite uplink, connecting him directly to the drone operator. He said the Defense Ministry had no further taskings. There was a moment of silence. The drone operator asked again if the Defense Ministry had any further taskings. Lin Bao repeated himself into the handset. Nothing. There'd been some breakdown in communications. A member of Lin Bao's support staff rushed into the conference room, untangling wires beneath the table, toggling switches on and off at the back of the satellite uplink, while Lin Bao repeated over and over again that he'd seen enough, that he had no further taskings, that he didn't need to see any more. There was no response. Lin Bao kept repeating himself. He was frantic to deliver his message, frantic to hear a response on the other end of the line from that hollow, disembodied voice.
11:49, July 20th, 2034, GMT plus 5:30, New Delhi. Vice Admiral Patel immediately ordered two taxicabs, one for Farshad and the other for his nephew. The three of them hardly spoke as they waited. Farshad never considered himself a prejudiced man. In his mind, bigotry was a safe harbor for weaklings. However, all through his life, he'd noticed how on the few occasions he'd met an American, he'd immediately recoiled at their presence. He had a similar reaction to Israelis, though had an easier time self-rationalizing this response as something other than bigotry. But when Farshad witnessed Chaudhry's palpable grief as the first reports came in from San Diego and Galveston, he couldn't help but feel something akin to pity. What he did next not only surprised his American friend, but also surprised himself. As the two sat next to each other on the love seat in the Admiral's den, Farshad reached over and placed his right hand consolingly on the American's left arm. The first taxicab arrived. There was no question that Chaudhry would be taking it instead of Farshad. The American's need was more urgent. As his uncle shuttled him to the door, he turned to Farshad and said, "Thank you." Farshad said nothing in return. He suspected that the American was thanking him for the gesture from before, but he couldn't be certain. He reminded himself never to trust an American. Farshad asked Patel when the second taxicab would arrive. Instead of answering, Patel invited Farshad to sit with him a little longer in the den. Farshad made a slight protest. He, too, had to check in with the officials at his embassy. But Patel ignored him. "How about a cup of tea?" he said. Farshad's patience was running low, but he gathered up enough composure to accept the invitation. Somehow, despite himself, he trusted this old admiral. Patel disappeared into his kitchen and returned with the pot of tea. He sat next to Farshad on the love seat, their knees almost touching as Patel prepared Farshad's cup and then his own. Patel exhaled heavily. A tragedy, this. Farshad frowned. Inevitable, he replied, and then blew curlicues of steam from the surface of his cup. Inevitable? Asked Patel. Really? You don't think this could have been avoided? As he thought of the annihilation of two American cities, Farshad considered the ancient antipathies that existed toward the United States. Deep antipathies, not merely those of his own nation, but those of all the world. It was America's perpetual overreach that had led to today's events. How long could one country continue stoking up resentment before someone eventually struck a mortal blow? His word choice had been correct. Inevitable. He checked his watch and again asked about the cab. Patel ignored the request.
I can't say that I agree with you, he began. This conflict hasn't felt like a war, at least not in the traditional sense, but rather a series of escalations, each one greater than the last. But a single break in this chain of escalation could defuse the entire conflict and halt this cycle of violence. That's why my word is tragic, not inevitable. A tragedy is a disaster that could otherwise have been avoided. Patel took another sip from his tea, and Farshad could feel the old admiral's gaze from over the rim of his cup. If Patel was searching for agreement, he would have none. Farshad sat rigid in his seat, his shoulders swept back, his hands in his lap. His face expressed nothing. Patel continued.
You, above all others, should know that today could have been avoided. You were on the bridge of the Reiski when the Russians sabotaged the undersea cables. The Americans never would have launched at Zhanjiang had that accident not occurred. That's another word for you. Accident. Instead of three syllables, Patel spoke it in one, spitting it out, its falseness in his mouth like a bite into spoiled fruit.
Farshad became defensive. He offered other words, like miscalculation and unintentional, to describe what the Russians had done in the Barents Sea. But he knew they were lies and soon retired them, drawing silent and resigning himself only to,
How did you figure out that I was on the Reiski?
You just told me, Patel replied.
Farshad smiled. He couldn't help it. He liked this wily old man. Placing Farshad on the Reiski was a simple act of deduction on Patel's part. Farshad had flown through Moscow, and how many Iranian liaison officers did Tehran have assigned to the Russian fleet? Not many. Patel now asked his Iranian counterpart to engage with him in a similar deductive exercise. The Indian government, Patel explained, wanted its ship back from the Revolutionary Guards. Patel understood that unlike the Russians in the Barents Sea, the seizure of the privately owned tanker was an actual miscalculation that had led to an impasse between their two governments. After laying out the facts as he saw them, Patel expounded on the unique position of our two countries. According to Patel, arbitration of the Sino-American War now fell to India. Among the nations of the world, events had conspired to make New Delhi the best interlocutor between Washington and Beijing, and it would take Iranian cooperation as well. Only their countries had a chance of ending the hostilities. He alluded to sweeping actions his government might be called upon to take in the coming days.
Without our intervention, Patel explained, the Americans will counterstrike, and the Chinese will counterstrike the counterstrike. Tactical nuclear weapons will turn into strategic ones, and that will lead to the end, for all of us. But our intervention can work, and will only work if it's allowed to unfold freely. If no other nation interferes.
Patel turned to Farshad, like a spouse begging their partner to give up a lover. He said simply,
When I say interference,
I'm talking about the Russians. Farshad understood. He knew that Pateo saw the Russians clearly, just as he and his government saw them clearly. Farshad found himself thinking of Kolchak, who could trace his lineage to the Imperial Navy, his ancestors having served on both the Tsar's dreadnoughts and on the Soviets' guided missile cruisers. Within four generations, Kolchak's family had veered from imperialist to communist to capitalist, at least the current Russian version of capitalist. Did this mean that Kolchak's character and that of his ancestors was unprincipled and opportunistic? Or did it simply mean that he came from a people who had always done what they must to survive?
The world is in disarray, said Pateo, who took another sip of his tea, placing the cup delicately on its saucer. Do you think the Russians won't continue to take advantage of that? Do you think they'll stop with a ribbon of land in Poland?
Pateo didn't wait for an answer. Instead, he began to shake his head at Farshad.
You're next. The Strait of Hormuz is next.
Pateo then explained, in great detail, a Russian plan to seize Larak and Hormuz Islands, two rocky, treeless outcroppings strategically positioned in the center of the strait.
From those islands, their fleet could close down all maritime traffic. They could choke off the export of oil from the Gulf, skyrocketing the price of Russia's own oil. A nice little piece of extortion, don't you think?
Farshad had drawn silent.
Eventually, he asked, Why are you telling me this? I thought you'd be grateful, scoffed Pateo. You should be.
Farshad allowed the silence to return between them, and in that silence was an affirmation that he, like Pateo, understood that nothing was granted for free. If this information was true, there would be a price associated with it. If it were a lie, Pateo wouldn't ask him for a thing. Farshad sat on the love seat and allowed the old admiral to make his request.
We need your help, Pateo eventually said. First, we need our tanker released. Its seizure has caused quite a stir here, and that has been, well, embarrassing for us. However, and more importantly, when our government takes decisive action, it's very probable that the Pakistanis might use that as an opportunity to stir up trouble. Perhaps an attack on Kashmir, or some domestic terrorism sponsored by one of their ISI surrogates. When it comes to the Pakistanis, emotions run very high in our country. Perhaps you can understand how this would prove a distraction.
Farshad understood. Certain national identities were defined by certain national antipathies. What was more Persian than hating an Israeli? More American than hating a Russian? Even if Pateo wouldn't divulge what decisive action his country was planning to take, Farshad understood that like a pack of distracted children swarming a soccer ball, a crisis with the Pakistanis might prevent the politicians in New Delhi from acting strategically. What Farshad didn't understand was how he and his country were in a position to forestall Pakistani aggression.
The Pakistanis won't move without Beijing's approval, Pateo stated flatly. You've got the ear of the Chinese. Convince them to keep their Pakistani allies on a leash. That shouldn't be too difficult, should it?
And the Russians? Asked Farshad. Pateo gathered their two empty cups of tea and disappeared into the kitchen. When he returned, he was carrying a thick manila folder.
Our intelligence services have intercepted their plans, he said. It's all here.
Pateo handed over the folder, which detailed how a Russian Spetsnaz division, supported by a carrier battle group, would seize the two lightly defended Iranian islands in the strait. The entire operation would take a single day. Farshad skimmed the documents with a growing sense of alarm. There wasn't much time to avert this disaster, a week at best. The doorbell rang. It was the taxicab.
The driver will take you to the airport, said Pateo.
the airport? I imagine you want to get back to Tehran, to speak with General Bagheri. We've booked a flight for you. Pass along my regards. Tell him that we're happily anticipating news that our freighter has been released, and that we're very much looking forward to our partnership. Outside the window, the driver stood by his taxi. What is this decisive action you keep referring to? Farshad asked. General Bagheri is going to want to know. Farshad remained on the sofa, cemented in place, as if his returning to Tehran might be contingent on this last piece of information. Patel gave Farshad a long, appraising look. What we're going to do next will be dramatic, he answered. But it will end this war. Will you trust me? Patel placed his hand on Farshad's arm.
1207, July 20th, 2034. GMT plus 530. New Delhi. Over and over again, Chaudhry kept calling her. Sitting in the back of the taxi cab on the way to the embassy, he was in a panic. Samantha wouldn't answer her phone. He kept dialing and dialing. Nothing. His former mother-in-law, that Texan wasp Chaudhry had never felt any affinity for, lived in Galveston, her health failing, her only enjoyment the ocean air and those periodic visits from her daughter. As he crossed from the east to the west bank of the Yamuna River, Chaudhry tapped out an email to Samantha. Have tried you many times. Please call. Sandy. A new email popped into Chaudhry's inbox, an out-of-office reply from Samantha. I will be away from my desk and in Galveston on a family matter until Monday, July 24th. If the issue is urgent, please try my cell phone. Like that, she was gone. The grief Chaudhry felt wasn't for the loss of her. The two hardly had a relationship. It was for his daughter. Their daughter. How many times over the years had he secretly hoped that Samantha, his stalwart antagonist, might vanish in such a way? Lost in a plane crash. Incinerated in a fire. Killed in a car wreck. He had, guiltily, harbored such fantasies. However, had any of these fantasies proven true, it would have left Ashni motherless. And now that Samantha was gone, his guilt was as acute as if he'd killed her himself. In fact, he couldn't quite convince himself that he hadn't. When he arrived at the embassy, it was eerily quiet. He had expected to find a hive of activity as the ambassador responded to this crisis. Instead, the halls were mostly empty. Here and there, clusters of staff gathered around one cubicle or another. From the hushed tones of conversations, Chaudhry assumed the cubicle's occupants had lost a loved one in the attack. Otherwise, the mood was stunned silence. Chaudhry shut the door to the temporary office he'd been assigned. Though he didn't wish to admit it, he too was stunned. As he logged into his email, he hoped to find something that might recall him to his senses. At the top of his inbox, there was a message from Hendrickson. The subject line was empty, and even though they were communicating on a classified system, the text was cryptic. Our orders arrived. What do you hear? Bunt. Chaudhry knew those orders were for a counterstrike led by the Enterprise. It would be against the Chinese mainland. The days of indirect strikes, at power grids or disputed territories like Taiwan, were over. The counterstrike would follow this pattern of escalation. Zhanjiang had led to San Diego and Galveston, so the next logical step after the destruction of two American cities would be the destruction of three Chinese ones. The only question was which cities, a detail that Hendrickson had no doubt received in the recently arrived orders. While Chaudhry sat in front of his screen, struggling to compose a response, his cell phone rang. It was his uncle. Our Iranian friend just left. To where? Om, said Patel. Are you at the embassy? Chaudhry told him that he was. Nothing's going to get accomplished there, said his uncle. I'm on my way to the Defense Ministry. Come meet me.
Chaudhry made a half-hearted protest. He wasn't in New Delhi on an official diplomatic mission, and a meeting at the Defense Ministry broke any number of protocols. He would first need to secure the appropriate authorizations. His uncle listened, or at least the other end of the line fell silent, before he said,
Sandeep, we know the Enterprise has its launch orders. And I know about Ashni's mother. For that, I am sorry. We can tell her together if you like. But first, we need you to come to the Defense Ministry.
Chaudhry glanced out his window, to the vacant corridors of the embassy. He knew his uncle was right. Nothing was going to happen here, or at least nothing that might avert a counterstrike by the Enterprise. We'll take out 3 of their cities for hour 2. Then what?
They'll take out 4 of ours. Then we take out 5 more. Then come the doomsday weapons.
He could feel his loyalties shifting, not from one nation to another, but between those who wanted to avert an escalation and those who believed that victory, whatever that meant, could exist along this spectrum of destruction. Receiving the appropriate authorizations to visit the Defense Ministry suddenly seemed like an irrelevance. He increasingly felt as though his allegiance didn't reside with any government, but with whoever could reverse this cycle of annihilation.
All right, said Chaudhry, returning to his desk. I'll be there in 30 minutes.
His uncle hung up. Chaudhry couldn't help but wonder how the Indians knew that the Enterprise had received their launch orders. It could have been a myriad of intercepts made by their intelligence services, but Chaudhry suspected they'd intercepted his correspondence with Hendrickson. If they had, their ability to hack into his classified email demonstrated a level of cyber sophistication beyond what he and his country had previously thought them capable. When Chaudhry crafted his reply to Hendrickson, he now did so with the knowledge that others might be reading it. In response to the question, "What do you hear?" he wrote, "The Indians might do something."
1532, July 23rd, 2034, GMT plus 8, South China Sea. It was perhaps the loneliest moment of her life. Hunt stood on the bridge overseeing flight operations, but what she was really there to observe was Hendrickson departing to Yokosuka, then on to Honolulu, and finally back to Washington, where he'd been recalled via an immediate action request originating from the White House. When Hendrickson received the message, he'd crumpled the sheet of paper, tossed it in a burn bag, and muttered, "Fucking wise carver." Hendrickson had come to believe that he hadn't actually been sent to the Enterprise to check up on Hunt. He had been sent to the Enterprise so he would be out of the way when Wisecarver crafted the orders for the nuclear counterstrike. Now that the White House had dispatched those orders, he wanted Hendrickson back in Washington to keep an eye on him. He explained his theory to Hunt. "But I thought I was the one they didn't trust," she asked. Hendrickson replied,
"They don't trust you. It's just that they might not trust me either."
In this way, by both being untrustworthy to the same authority, they were once again Confederates in the hours that remained before Hendrickson's departure. This may have been why, watching his plane dwindle into a speck on the horizon, Hunt felt so spectacularly alone. She returned to her flag cabin. The orders for the counterstrike were locked in her safe, whose combination she struggled with, preoccupied as her mind was. She couldn't quite bring herself to focus on the detailed planning that would be required of her. Before he'd left, Hendrickson mentioned that he had it
on good authority that the Indians might intervene.
"Cut the shit. On whose authority?" she'd asked. Hendrickson would only answer,
"A contact of mine from Washington."
The fantasy of the Indians, or of anyone intervening, proved such an escapist distraction that it took her 4 attempts to unlock the safe. Then at her desk, she unfolded the orders, which totaled 3 pages, 1 for each of the targets, coastal cities that read from south to north: Xiamen, population 7.1 million. Fuzhou, population 7.8 million. And lastly, Shanghai, population 33.24 million. To both Hunt and Hendrickson, the inclusion of Shanghai seemed chillingly disproportionate. It was China's most populous city. A strike on Shanghai would assure a counter-strike on New York, Los Angeles, or even Washington. Which wasn't to say that the staggering number of lives lost in a place like Xiamen or Fuzhou wasn't grim enough. But it would be difficult to imagine a scenario in which a strike on Shanghai wouldn't result in an escalation from tactical to strategic nuclear weapons. It was, Hunt thought, a suicide mission. Not that the pilot wouldn't make it back, though that was unlikely enough. No, it was a suicide mission in the broadest sense. Its accomplishment assured the suicide of much, if not all, of mankind. As that thought lingered, there was a knock at the door.
"Come in,"
she said. Wedd stepped across the threshold, wiping some grease from his hands with a filthy rag. He then tucked the rag into the pocket of his flight suit and presented himself to Hunt, snapping to attention.
"Christ, at ease," she said. "I've told you that you don't have to do that."
Wedge again took the rag from his pocket, working the grease from his palms and beneath his fingernails.
"Customs and courtesies, ma'am. A simple sign of respect."
Hunt held the three pages of the order in front of her. "I appreciate that, but I don't need the extra deference."
"It's not specific to you, ma'am. It's respect for your rank."
He tucked the rag back into his flight suit. Hunt couldn't help it. She had come to like Wedge. He was insubordinate, but his insubordination didn't manifest itself in a refusal to follow orders or disrespect for his superiors. He was, instead, insubordinate in the broadest sense. He was insubordinate to the time in which he lived. He refused to give up the old ways. Or, put differently, he refused to stop believing in them. Where did Wedge think all this would lead? Wondered Hunt. Did he imagine that a bygone order would one day reassert itself? That he could somehow fly through the fabric of time to arrive in a different, better, and older world? Perhaps his insubordination was a form of denial, a rejection not only of the present, but of all that was to come. No matter, she thought cruelly, as she handed him the order for the counterstrike.
"What's this?"
he asked, thumbing through the pages. Hunt didn't need to tell him. He could read it for himself. Xiamen, Fuzhou, Shanghai. His left eyebrow ticked upward when he read the last one. Aside from that, he sat across from her stone-faced.
"When can you be ready?" she asked.
"Day after tomorrow,"
said Wedge. That would give his pilots a full night's rest. The Hornets, antiquated as they were, could also benefit from the attention of a 24-hour maintenance stand-down. Each crew chief could then conduct a full inspection of the avionics, airframes, and weapons systems, all of which had proven temperamental during their training runs.
"That's fine," said Hunt. "We don't need to launch any earlier than that."
"Three flights of three,"
answered Wedge.
"That sound about right to you?"
Hunt glanced down at her desk and nodded. "Which flight will you take?"
"I figured I'd take Shanghai."
When he said the name, all Hunt could think was 33.24 million people. The same with the other cities turned targets. Fuzhou wasn't Fuzhou anymore. It was 7.8 million people. The same for Xiamen, 7.1 million. "Wedge," she said, his name catching for a moment in her throat. "A lot of folks are calling this a suicide mission." Wedge folded up the three sheets of paper Hunt had given him and stuffed them in the same pocket as his dirty rag.
"Ma'am, I don't do suicide missions. We'll get her done and make it back here."
For a moment, Hunt thought to tell him that wasn't what she meant by suicide mission. But she thought better of it. Wedge snapped to attention and was dismissed.
1925, July 29th, 2034. GMT plus 8. Beijing. It took 4 days before Lin Bao realized that his wife and daughter had fled the city. He'd last seen them when he left for work on a Tuesday. He had stayed that night at the ministry as well as the night that followed. He'd come home the following morning, a Thursday, and had slept from 9 o'clock until 3 o'clock in the afternoon before returning to the ministry. He'd worked all the next day and through that night into Saturday. When he came home around lunch, the house was empty. He began to wonder where his family was. When he phoned his wife, she answered on the third try. She and her daughter were staying in her mother's village in the countryside, hundreds of miles inland. "Until this is over," she had said. Lin Bao asked to speak with his daughter, but she was out taking a walk with her grandmother. "I'll have her call you back." "When?" Lin Bao had asked. "Soon," answered his wife. Lin Bao didn't protest. What right did he have to? If anything, he was jealous of his wife and daughter, jealous of the time they had together, jealous of their safety, of their distance from the capital, and of their decision to leave it. He'd been indulging in escapist fantasies of his own, imagining what his life might be like when he left the Navy. He was indulging in one of these fantasies as he settled down in his empty house, rooting around the mostly bare fridge for some dinner. Early the next morning, he would need to return to the ministry to monitor the reentrance of the Zhenghe into territorial waters. He heated up a microwave meal, a burger and fries, his favorite indulgence, although it never cooked quite right in a microwave. The burger always wound up bland, the fries soggy, not like it tasted in the States. He watched the timer. He wondered again if perhaps he'd teach when this war was over. The idea of returning to the academy or to any of his country's war colleges was unappealing. Their curricula were merely programs of regurgitation. The professors had no input in their development. To teach the way he wanted to, he'd need to settle in the West. However, with each passing day of the current conflict, that seemed more and more like an impossibility. And if he couldn't teach, he would at least use his retirement to refocus on his family, to reestablish his relationship with his daughter, which had lost the warmth it had known during their days in Newport almost a decade before. No one could take his family from him, he thought, as the timer on the microwave went off. Lin Bao took his meal in its plastic container and settled down on the sofa in the living room. He uncapped a bottle of Tsingtao and took a long pull. With one hand, he grasped his beer by the neck, and with the other, he held his remote as he scrolled through a series of unfamiliar television shows. How long had it been since he'd had a night alone like this? Feeling overwhelmed by his program choices and disoriented by being on his own, he struggled to relax. He couldn't quite bring himself to take advantage of his time off. Eventually, he rerouted his internet through an illicit VPN he'd downloaded, allowing him to watch an uncensored broadcast of BBC News from London. The pasty-faced anchor led with a story. "Coming from the open waters south of Japan in the Philippine Sea. According to reports, freighters transiting into and out of the Pacific had observed a massive fire. Ceaseless clouds of smoke billowed miles into the air. Early speculation leaned toward this being the result of an undersea drilling disaster. However, the BBC and other networks soon dispelled this theory. No energy companies had wells in that remote portion of the Philippine Sea. An intrepid private pilot had, with that afternoon's sun descending on her left tail wing, managed to fly the approximately 200 miles southeast from the Japanese archipelago of Naha. The BBC was live-streaming video recorded by the pilot, while the anchor, mumbling away, attempted to make sense of the images." Lin Bao set his beer on the floor and put his meal on a side table. He craned his neck forward, his face pressing closer to the television. It couldn't be. He would have heard. There would have been a cry for help. But then Lin Bao thought of them heading west, their stealth technology fully engaged while maintaining the discipline of a communications blackout. A student of history, he recalled the USS Indianapolis, which had gone down in the Philippine Sea almost 100 years before, sunk by a torpedo fired from a Japanese submarine. It had taken 4 days for the Americans to realize what had happened. Lin Bao continued to watch closely, his eyes unblinking. The pilot, who was narrating parts of the live stream, explained that she had to keep her distance. Secondary explosions made it difficult for her to approach any closer. Her plane rattled in the turbulent air. Then, through a break in the smoke, Lin Bao saw it. The familiar slope of its prow, the gentle arch where its anchor lay. His old ship, the Zhenghe. She was ablaze, listing hard to starboard. The news anchor still didn't understand what he was looking at. He fumbled along through his broadcast, hypothesizing along with his co-anchor as to what all this smoke and fire at sea could possibly mean. Lin Bao, however, was already up from his seat, out the door, and on his way back into the ministry. He forgot to switch off the television. An hour later, when his daughter returned his call, he wasn't available to take it.
12:25, July 29th, 2034, GMT plus 5:30, New Delhi. This was Chaudhry's second trip to the Defense Ministry in as many weeks. His first trip had proven eventful by way of introductions. Over lunch, Chaudhry had met the Defense Minister himself, the Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces, and an extensive retinue of staff officers. Sitting around an oval table in the minister's personal dining room, each of them had offered their condolences for the atrocities at Galveston and San Diego. None of them knew about Chaudhry's ex-wife or his recently motherless daughter, so these condolences felt impersonal, like one nation's theoretical expression of sympathy for another. No one had said anything of substance in that first meeting. It had served to open a dialogue. Now Patel had recalled his nephew to the ministry for a second time. They met down by security. Despite Patel's retired status, he had a badge that listed him as permanent staff, allowing him to come and go as he pleased. When Patel arrived, he cut to the front of the security line and was promptly handed a visitor's badge for his nephew. The two were waved through a turnstile by an alert, white-gloved soldier in his service dress. Patel walked briskly, with Chaudhry trailing a half-step behind. Unlike the day before, when they'd followed the long corridor toward the upper-floor offices of the senior ministry officials, Patel led Chaudhry down to the basement. With its low ceilings and flickering halogen bulbs, this was the domain of minor officialdom. Eventually, they found themselves at a small canteen.
"Let me buy you a cup of tea," said his uncle.
Chaudhry followed him inside. There were only 3 tables, each empty. Patel explained that the woman at the cash register was the pensioned widow of a long-since-martyred soldier. Patel paid, dropped a few extra coins in her tip jar, and offered the elderly widow his most convivial smile.
"I was hoping we could talk unofficially," Patel began as they sat. "When I brought you here last week to meet the Defense Minister and Chief of Staff, it was to convey to you that I speak for the senior-most levels of our government. Understood?"
Chaudhry nodded. He didn't quite understand why he'd been chosen as the receptacle for whatever message his uncle seemed poised to deliver. Why wasn't this proceeding through official channels, through the ambassador, or even some lesser embassy official? As if in anticipation of these concerns, his uncle explained,
"Within your government, certain parties have a strong interest toward escalation. They will knowingly misinterpret our actions. Because of this, it is important for you to convey clearly both what we have done, but also what we are willing to do."
Chaudhry studied his uncle.
"By certain parties, who do you mean?" "I believe you know who I mean," answered Patel.
"Wisecarver?" asked Chaudhry quietly.
Patel neither affirmed nor refuted Chaudhry's guess. He took another sip of his tea before explaining. "Our government, specifically the leadership in this building, is not choosing a side. We are not supporting Beijing, and we are not supporting Washington. We are allied with no one. Our support is for de-escalation. Do you understand?"
Chaudhry nodded.
"Good," added Patel. Because what I'm about to show you might be confusing to your national security staff.
From his pocket, Patel removed his government-issued cell phone. He began to scroll through a series of photographs taken along the surface of the ocean, with waves cresting in the bottom of the frame. Superimposed over each image was a reticle, as if from a gun sight, with cross-hatched X and Y axes bisecting its width and length. As Patel scrolled through each picture, the ship on the horizon drew closer, until Chaudhry could clearly observe an aircraft carrier. Patel paused for a moment, glanced once more at his nephew, and then cycled to the next photo. An inferno of smoke and flames obscured and consumed the carrier. Patel paged quickly through the pictures that followed as if each were an image in a flipbook, animating the burning carrier as it slipped beneath the waves. When his uncle came to the last photograph, which was of the calm and consuming sea again at rest, he put words to what Chaudhry had witnessed. These are periscope photographs from one of our upgraded Calvary-class diesel-electric submarines. Their modified propulsion system affords them an essentially unlimited range, equal to any of your nuclear submarines. We've used one to sink the Zheng-He.
As his uncle had promised, Chaudhry was perplexed. You sunk the Zheng-He, but you are not allying yourself with the United States?
Correct, said Patel. Our interests are to de-escalate this conflict. If your government takes any retaliatory action for Galveston or San Diego, it won't be a Chinese ship that we sink next, but an American one.
Patel presented his nephew with another image, a map that showed the approximate disposition of Indian naval forces in and around the South China Sea.
And as you'll see, this isn't a hollow threat.
Patel's map seemed an impossibility to Chaudhry. If accurate, it meant that dozens of Indian warships had infiltrated into the South China Sea undetected, representing a gross underestimation of India's stealth cloaking and cyber capability by his own country. Chaudhry's thoughts shifted to a couple of days before, how his uncle had learned of the Enterprise's receipt of launch orders against the Chinese mainland. He was increasingly certain that Patel knew this through Chaudhry's email exchange with Hendrickson. If the Indians possessed enough sophistication to hack into a state-of-the-art encrypted email system, was it not also likely that they possessed the sophistication to position their fleet clandestinely between the Enterprise and the Chinese mainland?
Our defense attaché visited the White House and showed these pictures to your national security advisor.
And? Chaudhry asked his uncle.
He was thanked and escorted out of the building.
Chaudhry nodded.
It is my belief that your Mr. Wise Carver never passed along these materials or news of our attaché's visit to anyone else in the administration. It is also my belief that your Mr. Wise Carver has no intention of expressing the nuance of our government's position to your president.
Your beliefs are likely correct, answered Chaudhry. So why are you telling me this? They'd finished their tea. Patel gave his nephew a glance, then went back to the register where the cashier sat. She poured him another two cups, but this time Patel neglected to drop a coin in her jar. Patel returned to his seat, picking up their conversation.
I am telling you all of this because perhaps there is another way to convey our message.
He handed Chaudhry his tea and fixed him in his stare, as if he were waiting for his nephew to speak. However, Chaudhry wouldn't say anything. By conspiring with his uncle in this way, he felt as though he were skirting a treasonous line. And so, Patel finished the thought for him.
Your friend Hendrickson might be able to communicate our message directly.
Going around Wise Carver to the president would likely end his career.
If the Enterprise launches a counterstrike, Patel answered gravely, much more will end than the career of one man.
The two of them sat quietly. Why are we meeting here? In this canteen? Asked Chaudhry. Why not in a secure conference room? He glanced at the cashier, who was nominally paging through a gossip magazine but who he suspected had been listening to them this entire time.
"Because we haven't had a meeting," answered Patel. "None of this is official. My government hasn't sanctioned my talking to you. As far as they are concerned, we're discussing my sister's health."
For the first time, Chaudhry felt uncertain who exactly his uncle spoke for. As if he could sense his nephew's unease, Patel added,
"To break certain impasses, sometimes we have to rely on a bond stronger than nationality. Sometimes the only bond that is strong enough is family."
Patel clasped his nephew by the shoulder.
"You will talk to your friend Hendrickson?"
Chaudhry nodded.
"Good," he said. "I'm late to a meeting. Can you find your way out?"
He nodded.
"Yes. And don't worry about her," Patel added as he got up. "She's near deaf. A tragic story."
On his way out, he glanced once more at the cashier. With that, his uncle was gone. Chaudhry sipped slowly from his half-finished cup of tea, puzzling over how to outmaneuver Wisecarver. He likely had only hours until the Enterprise launched its counterstrike against the Chinese mainland. He had no idea what the Indian response might be, or how his government might react. The task his uncle had placed before him seemed an impossible one. He must have appeared in pretty bad shape as he stood from his seat. He could feel the old widow at the cash register staring at him piteously. As Chaudhry passed by her, he reached into his pocket and took out some change, dropping it into her jar. She took his hand by the wrist, startling him. Her eyes were wide and watery with what seemed like nostalgia.
"Thank you," she said. "Thank you."
Chaudhry glanced down at her grip. "Think nothing of it." For another long moment, she wouldn't let him go.
1749, July 29th, 2034, GMT plus 430. Strait of Hormuz. He had been walking in circles. At least, that's what it felt like to Farshad, day and night, ever since he'd arrived on Hormuz Island, going in one big circle. He would check a fighting position, say an anti-aircraft gun, then proceed to the next, say a machine gun oriented on the beaches, then one of the new directed energy cannons, which never seemed to work. On and on he'd go, viciously kicking stones out of his path as he followed the few miles of perimeter, his only break being the brief boat ride between this island and its twin, Larak Island, where he walked a nearly identical circle. The defenses on the islands were paltry at best. A handful of anti-aircraft guns, a few hundred poorly trained conscripts, some barbed wire obstacles. That was about it. Did General Bagheri really expect him to defend these strategically critical islands with this? He couldn't be serious. And in fact, General Bagheri wasn't serious. Or at least, he didn't take the threat of a Russian invasion seriously. When Farshad had presented this prospect on his return from New Delhi, General Bagheri had sat behind his desk, plucking pistachios from a dish, knuckling open their shells while he listened patiently. Then, with indifference, he'd asked, "Is that all?" What had followed was the greatest dressing down Farshad had received in at least a decade. According to General Bagheri, the idea of a Russian invasion of the Hormuz Strait Islands was preposterous. Tehran and Moscow had been allied for decades. Furthermore, the information had come from the Indians, who were no great friends of either nation. Then, turning personal, Bagheri had said, "Lieutenant Commander Farshad," enunciating his full rank as if to remind him how far he had fallen. "I placed you in the Navy so that you wouldn't cause more problems. But now the Supreme Leader has himself read your warning of a Russian strike. Against my advice, he's chosen to release the Indian tanker, and he has also ordered me to reinforce our islands in the strait.
It seems I've been unsuccessful in keeping you out of trouble. General Bagheri informed Farshad that he had no choice but to follow orders. He was compelled to reinforce the islands. But his reinforcement would be a single person, Farshad. When he departed General Bagheri's office, it was to a small dhow that was waiting to take him to his new, desolate posting. Since arriving on the islands, Farshad hadn't allowed himself to wonder how much longer he would remain there. If the Russian invasion, those Spetsnaz parachutists supported by their navy, never arrived, how long would Bagheri keep him postured to repel an assault? A week? A month? A year? The rest of his pitiful life? Farshad had come to realize that by delivering his message directly to the High Command, he had become the architect of his own exile. The few hundred conscripts who manned these defenses had been enduring a similar exile, some of them for years. As Farshad mingled among them, he learned that most had a history of disciplinary infractions. These islands had become a dumping ground for hard cases. The supply depots sent them no fresh food, only packaged rations. They showered once a week. The tents they slept in were often blown away by the unpredictable winds that thrashed through the strait. Unlike General Bagheri, the men on the island had accepted the idea of a Russian invasion, even if such an occurrence seemed like an improbability. What were the odds? 1 in 10? Even less? But what else did they have to do but prepare? And how long would the odds have to be on their lives for them to take no precautions whatsoever? And so they filled sandbags. They calibrated the ranges on their anti-aircraft guns in precise intervals of 100 feet, and they endured incessant inspections by Farshad while they waited for the invasion. At night, under his tent, with no special accommodations afforded him, Farshad began to think of home. He wanted to return. The desire entered his dreams. It wasn't the comfort of his bed that he envisioned, or the warmth of his house, or a good meal. It was his family's land, specifically his garden. With the fierce winds whipping against his tent, surrounded by the sleeping heaps of rejected soldiers, he concluded that he'd seen enough. If he ever got off this rocky island, he swore to himself that he would finally go home, and he wouldn't again make the mistake of leaving. These dreams recurred fitfully each night, all except for this one. It was the only night that he slept the whole way through. It was also the only night that the wind shifted its course, dying down to a gentle breeze. This night, he dreamed most intensely of all. He is back in his garden, performing the routine he'd fallen into after his expulsion from the Revolutionary Guards. He writes his memoirs in the morning. He takes his walk at around noon, lunching beneath the elm tree on the far end of his property. When he finishes his meal, he leaves the scraps out for the pair of squirrels to eat. And he waits. He is conscious that he is dreaming, and he hopes that both squirrels might again appear. He thinks that this time he might restrain himself and not kill the squirrel if it bit him. Farshad waits a long while in this dream. The longer he waits, the more the landscape changes. The trees dry up, their brittle leaves falling around him. The thirsty grass turns to stubble and then to bleached rock. The rock is the same as the islands. The next morning, right at dawn, the wind returned. He woke up to its howl. It stretched the fabric of his tent before yanking up the stakes and sending that same tent tumbling toward the sea. Farshad lay in the dawn with nothing between him and the sky except for the wind. "Look!" one of the conscripts cried out. He pointed to the east, in the direction of the rising sun. Farshad squinted, making a visor of his hand. Dozens and dozens of them. More than he could have imagined. arranged like a vast migration of birds.
"They are here,"
he shouted to his garrison, but the wind drowned out his voice.